why not mix it up? Our guest is from Alabama.
Yeah.
Bingo.
Okay.
So thanks for joining us. This is We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
My name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape Machinery can get you pretty much anything you want when it comes to John Deere. Give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-22.
Yeah, 226.
226,
so
yeah.
Do the hand motions?
Yeah, yeah.
9226.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. I got to warm up here.
I wasn't even interrupting, just for the record. I was not interrupting time.
You're doing fine. Although, they're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake, and they've got a great inventory right now. Go up and see them, and they'll get you fixed up. Or you can catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Nice.
Yeah, there you go.
So let's see. Today would be June 11th, 2023, in case we replay this, because I think we will. It's a pretty fun topic, pretty interesting. So we have had like a hiatus, how about that, since we lost Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. And so we haven't talked about EMPs or any of that good stuff for a long time. And our friend Cynthia Ayers back there, she said, "Hey, I've got the perfect guy for you."
Mm-hmm.
So we're excited. You have a brand new guest, Greg Allison. He's the Alabama, hence the song, State Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. He's a subject matter expert in avionics system safety. I'm definitely not going to read the whole thing because it goes on forever, and he is involved in super interesting stuff. NASA, he's worked on the Artemis 1 space launch system, satellites. Let's see, what was the other really neat thing? He designed the architectural layout of the power and data system distribution for the International Space Station's nodes 2 and 3. We'll add more things as we go. But he also founded the High Altitude Research Corporation, HARC, to further develop the balloon-launched hybrid rockets. Won a NASA Phase 1 Small Business Innovation Research Grant, which is intended to be a paper study through which the HARC team actually executed a flight hardware program to develop and launch balloon launch return vehicle. All these things, and now we have, you know, Chinese spy balloons like flying over us. He has done a video called EMP Balloon Attack Threat from the Chinese Military, and I have linked that on the page. It's a YouTube video. It's on the page at wethepeopleradio.us, and if you click on June 11th, I'm also going to add Dr. Peter Pry's information to his page so you can go back and forth and listen to both. And we're just excited to have him on, and I'm excited because I found a lot of songs about balloons. So, Greg, I hope you like songs about balloons, because we're going to play those today for you. You seem like the kind of guy who could like some fun music. I mean, why not? It's a serious topic. We might as well have a little fun while we do it.
Amen. Amen, Aaron. Well, thank you, Aaron, for bringing me on with that introduction song, Sweet Home Alabama. I love it. You made me feel at home.
There you go.
Right off the bat. That song's used a lot in movies, too, if you haven't noticed.
They use it a lot everywhere, and I was like, yeah, but it's such a great song. I'm definitely going to use it. I'm going to get rid of our regular bumper music. Let's get right to it.
Awesome, awesome.
So Bill watched your video, and I watched your video, and we still are complete dunces about this, so we'll just shut up. And
well, the one thing I did learn is that we better start smartening up on this, or else we are going to be in a world of hurt.
We did learn that.
Yeah, and if the worst does happen, I think you can pretty much count on not surviving. It's that serious. So take it away, Greg.
This is very serious. And the problem is that now the threat from high-altitude balloons, especially from China, is much greater than even you dare to imagine. China has already conducted tests of the military weapon deployments from balloons, and according to some sources, they've even developed a branch of their military that can literally launch swarms of thousands of high-altitude balloons that can serve as decoys, platforms for reconnaissance, bioweapons delivery, bombs, missile launches, and worst of all, of course, is this high-altitude electromagnetic pulse as a sneak attack in a way that would be very hard to detect and very hard to defeat. And furthermore, It's all too easily done, and it actually is cheaper than the missiles. So a lot of people just aren't appreciating what can happen from a balloon. I know this. You know, I happen to have the intersection of experience of having chaired a couple power grid defense conferences, have become the state director and the late, great Dr. Peter Vincent's prize, EMP Task Force on National Homeland Security. And, of course, you may know, and you posted my link to my YouTube channel. And I hope everybody to go there and watch my YouTube video on this topic and on EMP topics. And you will find that I've had Dr. Pry on several times and a couple of other people from our EMP Task Force, to include National Operations Director Glenn Rhodes and David Pine. Is a deputy director of national operations. So I've had General Ken Krasniak. I've had several guests on the show talking about the topics of EMP, including David Womack and David Tice. David Tice has produced that documentary, Grid Down, Power Up. They had, what's his name as the moderator, Dennis Quaid. So sometimes I get brain locked, guys. It happens to even us rocket scientists. And that's something a lot of people don't understand. They think of Alabama as being the most backward state in the universe. But actually, Huntsville, Alabama has more PhDs per capita and more engineers per capita than any place in the free world.
No kidding.
So
did not know that.
No kidding. And all in one spot. And y'all got a lot in California spread out. But we got them all right here in one area in Huntsville, Alabama. A lot of people don't realize you can't throw a rock in Huntsville without hitting at least two or three engineers.
No kidding.
That's a joke I've told for a long time. And so it's an excellent place to develop programs, launch balloons and rockets and do programs like that from. But it's my intersection of expertise of having went out to the ocean to launch balloons with rockets on them and my expertise with EMP that taught me how easy this is to do. And when I see what what China is doing in their balloon developments, I know they know everything I know. Because it's out there in the balloon literature. If they get that many people digging through the balloon literature, the balloon flight, and becoming knowledgeable of the systems that's available, it's frightening what can be done. For example, I led teams on a shoestring budget. First as a club project. I mean, as a small society club project. And we launched a balloon that made the Guinness Book of World Records for the highest altitude flight of an amateur rocket off the coast of North Carolina. But launching from shore can be done or launched from the ground, but it's actually easier to launch from ships. And we actually, as a club, did a ship launch. Now, we took a ride, we hitchhiked a ride on the NASA barge for this, but after that, we spun a company off and we rented utility boats. And it was totally commercial, everything we did. And the company was a high altitude research corporation. So I've been out to sea launching rockets and balloons a few times. It's, I've done projects from $70,000 to $150,000 that could, you know, have the balloon launch return vehicle, which was a unmanned aerial vehicle that was remotely piloted and with a rocket on it to launch from a balloon. And we did the HARC, Health and Q Research Corporation, Chief Excess of Space Prize rocket called the Katz Prize rocket, which could have reached 100 kilometers. Now, most of the stuff that I talk about in the report has to do with launches that are actually detonations from balloons. And detonations from balloons, you need to be about 30 kilometers up to have the atmosphere to be just right to give you the most powerful EMPs. And so what that means is you've got to be where you don't. There's certain backscatter, and I guess the electrons will pull each other. What happens to the EMP is this. When the EMP, when a nuclear device goes off, it shoots out a lot of gamma rays. The gamma rays strip electrons off the atoms in the atmosphere. It's called the Compton effect. But anyway, they strip these electrons off and create a wave of electricity. And you get three waveforms from an EMP device. You get E1, which is a very high-frequency waveform, which will fry things with smaller circuits in it, like maybe your radio, perhaps your cell phone, your car, possibly. Although cars are kind of, we don't know a lot about what's going to happen to cars. We think it's going to be hit and miss because a car is kind of a Faraday cage, and it's dependent on a lot of things. But you expect a lot of your important stuff to get taken out by the E1. But there's also E2, which is like lightning, and then there's like a massive lightning wave. And then there's E3, which is a long wave component. And you also get E3 from solar coronal mass ejection. E3 will be picked up by power lines, by rail lines, by pipelines, any long conductors, even deep underground and undersea cables will pick this up. I know some people think, well, we bury it, we'll be fine. No. Kazakhstan had a nuclear test known as Test 184, and I believe I mentioned this in my full-length paper. That test, you know, fried a deeply buried power line in Kazakhstan. And so we know that these things are far more capable than you want to imagine. So most of the, when we developed our first mill standards to protect us from electromagnetic pulse, they, you know, we were going off of our little, we shot up on a redstone arsenal back in 1962, and it was called Starfish Prime. We shot up over the Jason Atoll, and this is before we had modern electronics. And bear in mind, too, Hawaii don't have long-range power transformers and power lines because it's an island. And that's the most vulnerable thing here in the United States. So they didn't have the kind of stuff back in 1962 to be as vulnerable as we did today. But still, it blew out street lights and had an impact on the grid in Hawaii, which was quite a distance away from Johnson Atoll. So today, fast forward to today, and you go to mainland United States, the most vulnerable things in our grid is those long-range, high-power transformers, which you could get the coils burned out in those things. And they're hand-wound coils. It takes 18 months to replace them. So if you fry these out, you can't get one in the loading dock into 18 months. But if they're all fried, how are you even going to order them? There's no bank accounts, no money. Your internet use requisition is gone. And according to the MP Task Force, the National Homeland Security, within a year, the societal collapse will take out 9 out of 10 people because you won't have water, you won't have power, you won't have communications. I mean, you can't pump water that power. You can't pump gas and trucks stop rolling. Your entire supply chain breaks down because you can't order replacement parts to keep the diesel trucks running if they could get the fuel. And they're not going to get the fuel either because they can't pump it in most cases. The refineries are going to have issues. Being able to run the refineries without power and all the infrastructure it takes to run them because, you know, things break down. You got to have replacement parts. How do you get to replace? The whole society unravels. If you think the supply chain issues, the recent Cerveza bug or whatever you want to call it was, I'll be terminology used here because I don't know how susceptible your platform is to challenges.
We get to say kind of, you know, I mean, it's the public airwaves, so we can't swear about it, but, you know, we can talk crap about the corona thing all the time.
I'm used to being on YouTube, and the platform will ding you for anything, so we have to learn code talk. So pardon me if I do a little code talk, but I'm used to covering things on YouTube, and it's like walking on thin ice in an earthquake with meteorites slamming ice all around your artillery shield or something.
And cleats.
Yeah, every time you say a word here, you got a cleat on it.
All of a sudden you hear
that semi.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it's like on YouTube. So especially when you cover these kind of topics that, you know, that I'm so off the cover. You know, my channel, I actually started my channel, and believe it or not, is an urban gardening channel. Here I'm a space guy, and I started an urban gardening channel. And somebody,
I thought you were like a worm farmer or something, right?
Yeah, I'm a worm herder, too. Rocket scientist and worm herder. I think worm herder is a higher calling. But anyway,
that's the greatest thing ever. I was like, oh, my gosh. I just, besides the fact that, you know, losing Dr. Pry was a massive loss for the whole world, I thought he would just love this. I mean, this would be like, let's have you both on. And he would just, there was nothing made me happier than to hear him laugh because he didn't laugh that often. And every now and then.
He was so fun to talk to.
He really loosened up and we just had a great time with him. Yeah. He'd come on like on holidays and I called him once and I said, hey, you know, you realize the day you booked is Father's Day? And he goes, yeah, I know, but it's Father's Day, so I can do what I want. I'd rather come on the show. And I was like, your family probably hates us. It was a lot of fun. Well, we really loved him. We better take a really quick break here, and then we're going to come back. We have Craig Allison will be our hostage, actually, for the entire 2 hours while we speak more on this topic. You can find us at We the People, and the website is wethepeopleradio.us. Good job, Bill.
Hey.
Would you like to ride? Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon?
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana safety message. Is your marijuana killing you? A testing of 1,000 NorCal dispensary samples found the majority had toxic mold or substances harmful to humans. As a bud tender, recommended THC products for treatment of medical conditions while you get sicker or exacerbate mental health issues. Get professional medical help and sue the dispensaries for the product and advice liability. Marijuana is not medicine for most Americans, and there's no medicine that is smoked. Remember, let's be careful out there.
That's what I thought was so funny about
that,
it.
That was an early song about the balloon swarms you're talking about.
Back to you, Greg.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting stuff there. So, guys, talking about how easy this is to do, from a ship at sea, it's easy to launch a balloon. On the ground, you have to have all kind of – the big balloons require a lot of special handling equipment. You have to lay it out in the direction of the azimuth of the wind. And then usually they hold the balloon really close to the ground as they inflate it, and they lay it out a little bit again because you don't want the wind to knock it over, because the balloon is a huge – you know, they might be over a million cubic feet in an envelope of a balloon, but that envelope is a very thin polyethylene plastic that's actually like three times thinner than a sandwich bag. And
oh,
so
wow.
they're
like a
huge bale, of course. So that makes it easy to rip them and tear them, and they don't want to do that. So they have a lot of special handling equipment on the ground to manage and keep it down in case the wind dust comes up. And then when they launch it, it's like they got this crane that rolls with it and releases it as it goes up. And so there's a lot of very complex equipment to launch a really big balloon on the ground. But it's easy. I've launched them on the ground. I've done them with my own makeshift equipment, laying them out in the direction. I use my own little launcher type stuff, not quite a crane, but we've done this. But from a ship, all you got to do with a ship is go in the same direction and speed as the wind, the same wind vector exactly. And you can let that balloon stand straight up. It's called freestanding inflation, and as long as you haven't got it inflated where it's going to take off like a rocket, where, you know, the thrust exceeds your weight so much that it's got a high rate of acceleration, you can almost launch it like a butterfly out of your hands. Mm. But if you got too much, you know, thrust on it, too much buoyancy, and it was what it is with balloons, it might jerk your arm off or pull you up with it. But anyway, we find launching from ships to be by far far easier than launching from the ground. And you can launch a big a balloon on a very small boat. The balloons that I tuck up rocket packages weighing up to 300 pounds were on the order of, we might have used 500,000 cubic feet in some of these balloons, 250,000. They were very easily launched on small boats. We used what they call a utility boat, which is just a basic work boat like they use out in the Gulf. It's not even a supply boat that's carrying supplies. It's smaller than that. And it's definitely not a cargo container ship. Well, you know, China has huge fleet of cargo ships. They can easily launch the biggest balloons there are. But you don't need a balloon that big. I mean, if you don't think of a balloon that big, maybe you're sending up, six missiles with nukes on them to go long range, which is doable, actually, unfortunately, or maybe more. I will send up rockets. My rockets were capable of reaching over 100 kilometers in altitude that I was sending up on these balloons. And that gives you a big footprint of what it could reach. Three rockets, like my Hart Prize Cat's Prize rocket, could EMP strike from that could almost cover the continental United States. Now, you've probably seen, or some people that have followed this topic have seen, the concept for a high altitude burst that would be at the altitudes of 480 kilometers, 400 kilometers, say over Omaha or Kansas, somewhere in that area. And you see, you cover the entire continent of the United States, practically, so maybe Maine, with a waveform strong enough that you're right at the threshold of what they harden the military facilities at, which I started to speak to earlier. Now, but in the center, it can be incredibly strong. The scary thing is, see, what I said is we harden our facilities to a standard that was based basically on our idea that we might get, you know, some accidental EMP from nukes in general use and like Starfish Prime. But what's happened is Russia has invented something called an EMP super weapon. So we were worried about something on the order of possibly, a, you know, 30 to 50,000 volts per meter. Russia developed a system that could actually put out 200,000 volts per meter. Our original spec was to harden it to 50,000 volts per meter, and they've upped it to 85,000 volts per meter, but it still doesn't match the EMP waveform that could be put out by the EMP super weapon. And furthermore, you could... I've seen a presentation where a guy actually developed his own EMP generator, electronic version, and he had it in the van, and he set this thing off, and it was like 34,000 volts per meter is what he was outputting, and he was still defeating with that system the EMP safeguards in those facilities that were supposed to be hardened to 50,000 volts per meter. So our entire military so-called hardened secure network is completely at risk. This idea that everybody thinks, oh, not to worry, they won't do it to us because we'll retaliate with our submarines at sea if they take out everything on land. Our submarines at sea require an emergency action message, an EAM. Without that message, they're electronically set where they cannot launch. It's a so-called safeguard. If you ever saw, unfortunately, maybe Crimson Tide, which also had Roll Tide song playing in it. Sweet Home Alabama.
Yeah.
But it was one of those movies. But unfortunately, you know, at the end of that movie, they explained that the scenario in that would not play out because since then they had fixed the system where that couldn't occur. Well, when doing so, you've also tied the hands of the commanders in a true emergency situation. Like probably the most probable situation if we got attacked is we'd get an EMP attack, and that would possibly thwart all ability to give an EAM to our submarine fleet at sea. Our military command and control structure would be fried. Any satellite that was on the side of the Earth where the EMP occurred would be fried. If it's high enough to leave electronic cloud, yeah, the very first communications satellite, Telstar 1, was fried by the Starfish Prime. The first EMP fried the first satellite that we had up there for those purposes, Telstar 1. So that just gives you an idea that these things are real, they're powerful, and we are not prepared. The scary thing is that, like I said, it's too easy to do from a ship. You could do, let me give you an idea about range. Now, what I was talking about was the power, the concentration, if you launched it from altitude. But if you're coming down with a lower range with the same weapon, as long as you're, say, over 30 kilometers, you're going to probably produce a field, instead of being spread out, all that's going to be concentrated in a much smaller area. You're going to have a super strong EMP field. And the Chinese spy balloon, the one that came over the United States, was floating at about 50,000 to 60,000 feet. And so everybody thinks they're easy to take down because our jets were flying around them. But that balloon was at an altitude that's maximized for lower velocity winds. If you get down to where most passenger jets fly, you have the jet stream, what we call the jet stream, and you got pretty good velocity winds there. If you go to the altitude of the so-called Chinese spy balloons, you're actually in a lower velocity wind, which is ideal for reconnaissance. It's ideal for spying because you can loiter over your area a lot longer, especially if you got a little bit of onboard propulsion, which apparently they did. So that makes a perfect spy balloon altitude, but it puts it within the range of our jet fighters and that AIM-9 missile. You get these balloons up to 80, 100,000 feet. About 80,000 feet, you're going to be beyond the range of the jet fighters. You can send these things to 120,000 feet easy, maybe 140,000 feet. The actual Chinese spy balloon was set for 30 kilometers. At 30 kilometers, it's 18.64 miles, so you're going to be above the range of our weapon systems. Now, if you go look up the AIM-9 missile on the internet and study it, it will tell you it's got a range of 20 miles. You go, well, there ain't no problem. You can reach 20 miles. No, that's flying straight out from an airplane from where it's launched on the glide path. Going straight up, it can't do that because it's only got a burn time of maybe 5.4 to 6 seconds, which is a small motor compared to the overall size of the missile. So the thrust of weight, I mean, the specific mass of the system, the specific impulse, excuse me, is... it's low. The thrust to weight ratio just well, not that, but it's mass fraction. That's what I'm trying to say. I get brain wrong. The mass fraction is too much mass. It's just not good enough to make it reach altitude. At best, an AIM-9 going straight up is going to go maybe 10,000 feet. So that's about all you're going to get an AIM-9 aimed straight up. It's not going to get that cross-range distance that you see advertised. It ain't going to get anywhere near close to it because it just don't have the mass fraction or the burn time on that motor to achieve those kind of altitudes. It's going to be like shooting a roundup from an onboard fighter. Some fighters have these 20-millimeter cannons. Well, they're not going to go over 10,000 feet either. But even if you could get an AIM-9 up to the balloon, even if you could shoot at the 20-millimeter cannon at the balloon altitude, you're just going to make a bunch of holes in it, which, you know, it's kind of like this, these balloons are so huge. The biggest ones are the size of the astronaut, but even the ones I flew were pretty darn big. And you knock a hole in it, it's kind of like just opening a barn door. Or not even a barn door. It's not opening a door or window in a warehouse. It's not going to make a big difference. It's going to take a long time to degas it. The super pressure balloon, though, it was super pressure. It was a little bit easier to pop, but these are zero pressure. I think what they'll use for an EMP attack will be zero pressure balloons launched from shore from ships. They may send some over from China, but you're going to see those coming from a long time. So it's two kind of balloons, super pressure balloons and a zero pressure balloon. Let me step back and explain that. What we saw with spy balloon is what you call a super pressure balloon. It had an envelope inside of an envelope. The inner envelope in it was called a ballonet, and you'd put helium in it. The outer envelope that you would see actually contained the inner envelope plus air that could pump in and out of it for ballast and keep the overall shape the same. So it was a dual envelope system. Now, they can set the altitude on these to fly where the EMP spy balloons were, or they've actually designed that system to be able to take 1.1 metric tons to 30,000 feet. And it's very interesting they picked that 30,000 feet. Now, that's from their own agencies. It's very interesting that they picked the 30,000-foot set point because that is the perfect optimum altitude for an EMP attack. So that just speaks volumes to me as to what they're really going for here. That really concerned. It gets you out of the range of the jet fighters. So, you know, maybe you could take it down with a Aegis missile. But how many Aegis missiles do you have? Not that many, especially send a swarm of these over. Now, if you see them coming from a distance, you might figure out something to come. That's when I think that the primary attack would be from the zero-pressure balloons, which are cheaper. They're easier to launch. You launch them offshore. The zero-pressure balloons don't have an envelope in an envelope. It's just one big, ginormous Paul Bunyan sandwich bag with a payload attached underneath. They've got an open vent line on the bottom, so if they were ultra-thin, so if they were to try to overpressurize, you won't pop it. The gas will just escape out the open vents in the bottom. Or you have vent cubes, either vent cubes or open vents in the bottom. I've flown both styles. You can combine them. But the bigger ones typically have these vent tubes, which is also can be used as fill tubes when you're filling the balloon. So you can have like four fill tubes and be gassing it up to get it up real fast. So what happened most likely is they would go about 400 miles offshore with a zero-pressure balloon because if you had a radar that could look out and see this and from 400 miles, I'm saying most of our radars are like this are good at 250 miles or something like that. But if you had a radar that was looking over the shore and you saw it just as soon as it popped up over the horizon because of the curvature of the Earth, my friends in the flat Earth world, because of the curvature of the Earth, that balloon is already going to be over 80,000 feet from 400 miles out.
Wow.
A little too late at that point.
Bingo. Exactly. You're not going to reach it with anything you got. If you can mysteriously instantly transport your fighter jet with AIM-9s underneath it, too late. So that's my point. And they've only, and it's almost in range of shore from the EMP. So let me tell you about these EMPs from a balloon. From a balloon, the radius, if it detonated right there, the radius you can reach at we'll take different altitudes here, 30 kilometers, the radius is 442.34 miles. That's how far the EMP waveform would go. So you're already going to take out most everything on the shore, even if you're 400 miles out. So if you get this thing up to 120 kilometers, which I think would actually be their set altitude because it's harder to reach and get a little bit more reach with the EMP waveform. It's to be super concentrated EMP, super concentrated. At 120,000 feet, the radius is 488 miles. Now, I imagine they would set these things to drift really close to shore before they detonate. So you could take out all our coastal facilities, all our military facilities, ports, airports, the cities, the manufacturing. I mean, if you look, most of the thing we have is on the coast. If they want to reach inland, just detonate a balloon. This could be a small balloon. It could be a balloon smaller than the ones I was using to launch rockets from, because that was about a 300-pound payload. I could design a balloon, and I did this in my paper in my presentation. If you look on YouTube, I actually show how to design a system that you could send up that would be something over 150 pounds, and you could set up an EMP from that. And it would be an easier to swallow balloon than I was dealing with. And you could just launch dozens of these things. If you had two ships off the East Coast, two ships off the Gulf Coast, and two ships off the West Coast, you could devastate our entire coastal areas. Now, one side or the other, if you're not there, there's high-altitude winds. Okay, what I didn't say, once you get above that lower wind threshold where the part of spy balloons fly, you get higher. You get into higher winds, higher than even the jet stream, usually. So when you're at, 80 to 140,000 feet, you're in a high-speed wind environment. And you might be going 200 miles an hour even. It's usually a little bit less than that, but you can really pick up. So these balloons could start going toward inland really fast from that altitude. And they're going to be above range of most anything that might hit them. Now, the really smart people with this might say, well, they might try to EMP us. To stop us. And the problem with that is that balloon probably, the whole initiation mechanism might be something as simple as a wind-up timer that cuts a cut-down mechanism. Let's use a lot of balloons to drop the package. And the dropping the thing, it might just be it drops the, I would say they put sand around so we wouldn't detect the radiation, and then they drop the sand bucket that's around the nuke device, and the balloon will shoot up. Either way, it's going to get an acceleration. And if you should find a way to shoot it down, it's going to get an acceleration, which would probably trigger the cut-down device. And then the trigger on the actual nuke device would just be an accelerometer. So if it shoots up or falls down, it goes off. So if you let this thing get to altitude, you're in danger, and there's not much way to deal with it. You got to get it before it gets to altitude. Now, a lot of people will think, well, laser will take care of balloon. There's nothing. We can cut it up with a laser. Laser beams, even these so-called high-power laser beams and fried drones and all this stuff they talk about in their advertising now and ballyhooing, well, one, they're overhyped. But two, that's actually a short-range weapon because the laser over distance has a phenomenology called beam spreading. Your altitude of these balloons, you're 20 miles up. You've got to shoot through a lot of atmosphere. If you were shooting straight up, it might not be so bad, but you're going to have to shoot diagonally across the atmosphere. You get that balloon, you're going through a lot of atmosphere. Laser is going to spread out to the point that it's not even going to warm up the balloon. You'll be able to sit in the balloon, but it's going to be, that's not, if you were sitting up there in the balloon, you'd be laughing, oh, somebody's putting a laser at us.
What's the effective range of a laser?
Well, it depends on the system. A lot of that stuff is probably classified data. They got some shipboard lasers that have come out with them just released. They're probably the most powerful military lasers out there. The Army's got some that they put out. But the effective range, it works within the near tactical battle space, but not at a strategic distance,
right.
Not at a balloon distance. It won't work if for miles and miles that we're talking about. We're talking miles and miles and miles.
Oh, yeah.
Too much beam spread. It won't do anything.
All right. Hold that thought. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Greg Allison. We are talking about EMPs and spy balloons and all that stuff today. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
The world's spinning round like a loony balloon. Heading for a collision with Saturn and Mars, and we're narrow. generally missing the man in the moon. Spinning out of control, crashing into the stars. Have we all lost our gravity, reason and sanity? Is this the price that we pay? Have we all lost our way on this loony balloon?
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana safety message. Did you know that the marketing of marijuana is a misogynistic and racist activity? That's right. Most marijuana corporations are owned and controlled by rich, fat cat, white corporate types, and most dispensaries are placed into depressed communities of color. These communities can least afford the chains of drug addiction and corporate greed. For more information about marijuana, please visit sources like ALM, Americans Against Legalizing Marijuana, at www.aalm.info. And remember, let's be careful out there.
We're out of control on this loony balloon. Narrowly missing the planets and stars. Even optimists say that it's all gloom and doom. We've got to get somewhere or hit something soon.
I think that's obvious. So back to the lasers, because people do think we could use lasers to defend ourselves, but that's just not you just don't have that technology.
Well, they're good at the theater space, which means close to where you're fighting for some applications. So, but they're not good over long distance yet. We don't have the lasers that can do what we need for this application. So we're just not there at this point in time. I'm not saying we can't get there. I'm just saying we're not there at this point in time. So these balloons would be very hard to defeat with current systems. Your aircraft's not going to reach you. Your AIM-9's not going to reach you. You could get over the Aegis missile, ground-based interceptor, but we're talking millions of dollars of missile, and we only got a few of them, and they may send dozens, hundreds, or thousands of these balloons over. It may be a mix of balloons launched from China and balloons from offshore even. And there could be a lot of decoys, or it could be like the Japanese Gofu balloons that were sent up during the 40s to start fires, or spread rust disease to wipe out our crops. They could be carrying drones on board that could be used to have combat roles or intelligence roles. It could be a very big multi-pronged mission that they come at us with. So
when you were watching the balloons fly over the U.S. here, and everybody else was going, wait a minute, what? Balloons, they're flying balloons. I think most people thought that's such old technology, that doesn't really mean anything. But my guess is your hair was on fire.
That's a great weapon. That is one such a great weapon.
Yeah.
It's an asymmetric weapon because nobody expects it. Nobody's planned for it. And because of that, we don't have a good way to deal with it. And that's why, I know what you can do for balloons, and I know they're going to be hard to detect and hard to defeat, especially if they launch them offshore in the manner I'm talking about, because their mission time is just going to be a few hours. They could detonate these balloons outside of U.S. airspace, out over the ocean, and totally take out our coastal regions.
Yeah, that's even
reaching this country.
Right, and that's a scenario where we would have to first strike something that's in pretty much international waters. So how do you determine if it's a threat or not when it's 400 miles from your shore, which pretty much anybody can be out there?
Detection is going to be the key thing. And from shore, you're not going to detect it fast enough. You're not going to see this stuff until it's already too late. It's going to be at 80,000 feet, and it's going to be close enough. If you had some way of transporting something to it, taking it down the instant you could see it pop up over the horizon, and you don't, and you won't even know what it is when it first pops up on the horizon.
Sure.
The guys, the radars, if they could see it, which I don't think they will at that distance, they got to scratch their heads and pick their nose for a few minutes just to figure out what's going on. And then, well, what do we do about it? There's a better way, and it takes time to scramble fighters and all that, and it's going to be too late. So there's a better way to deal with this. And that's the good news. There's different ways. I think the best way to deal with this would be to have some drones flying offshore, off the coast of the United States, close to the edge of the ADIZ. I mean, let these drones get out there 300-400 miles out. And it's, well, they too are limited by range, but, you know, let them get as high as they can, maybe 200-300 miles out. Well, I say 300 miles, it'll be at least 300 miles out, so they can watch these areas offshore. And they will need to use side aperture radar so they could resolve threats out there in the ocean, and in conjunction with AI. What they would be looking for is the signature of a boat that's traveling for at least an hour, going exactly with the speed and direction of the wind. There's no need for most boats to travel in the speed and direction of the wind. If you see that, then bingo, you got something to suspect in terms of a balloon launch. And so then they need further investigation. Now, Predator drones also have side aperture radar, and they carry little missiles on them. They can actually include the A-9. And if you could go in lower and get this balloon before, if they launch a balloon, you just swoop in and get it before it gets to any altitude.
But again, if they do this in numbers, and they do send in like a swarm with a bunch of decoys, you just don't have enough.
You don't need a bunch of drones out there. You don't need a bunch. And as soon as they detect something like this going on, you might could call shore and get the fighters out there. You know, so you got a certain amount of time it takes to mobilize and get stuff on spot. But that's the good thing, is that if you catch this thing early enough, you know, by the time they release that balloon, it's going to take it maybe an hour to get to 80,000 feet, maybe an hour and a half to get to total operational altitude. So you got a little time if you detect it early, but you've got to detect it early. Drones can take down some of them. Maybe fighters could take some out before they get to great altitude. I think it'd be good to have a set of drones. I also think we ought to have some ships at sea that are also capable of launching balloons. For one, they could be monitoring for this stuff, and they could also launch balloons with long-range communication systems on board. A network of these would make up for a loss of satellites due to, say, an MP or a Chinese asymmetric anti-satellite warfare activity that would be aimed at keeping us from communicating, having operational intelligence, and from sending our EAMs out. I mean, they'll do everything they can to thwart us getting our EAMs to our submarine fleet. That's something a lot of people don't think that they're preparing for, but you know darn well that's exactly what they're mostly preparing for. They don't want our submarines to launch.
Right.
So they will do everything they can to avoid that. And, fortunately, the Dr. Pye taught us that the Russians actually can launch from the submarine bases. They don't even have to deploy their submarines. They're already connected in, hardwired their submarines where they're at, so they get all the intel they need. So, we're not prepared except the same way a lot of the countries. People think that we're ahead this way and that way, but a lot of these other countries have kind of outfoxed us in certain regards. And we're just not thinking that way. We're not prepared. We got this mantra, nuclear war can't be fought, it can't be won. Well, they can be fought, and they can be won. And unfortunately, the way to win it is to be the one that launches the first strike. Now, then you can take out all your opponent's systems, and with EMPs, you can take out the retaliatory capability with the submarines at sea. And that country's prostate. I mean, you're sitting there sizzling. The scariest thing of all is the following philosophy. The Russians consider an EMP weapon, the release of an EMP weapon, the set off of an event like that, to be electronic warfare. They do not consider it nuclear warfare because it does not impact the homeland. You get no radiation on the homeland that whoever's getting attacked. It's a pulse that takes out electrical systems. Initially, nobody dies directly from the EMP. Not a person.
True. Right.
But what happens is your society totally collapses because electricity is your Achilles heel, your bank accounts don't work, your cell phones don't work, you can't pump water, you can't pump fuel, your internet's gone, all your comm systems gone, the societal collapse over the ensuing year will take out 9 out of 10 people. You know, if you should have found a way to order that transformer, by the time it gets there, you got no technicians to put it in.
Right.
So, you know, right now we're having labor shortages. Just imagine where you'd be when 9 out of 10 people are gone and they're fighting over everything. You know, the country will be in turmoil. So, my humble opinion is, given that the difficulty of ordering the components and to replace them, you know, we're not talking about, you know, like we lose a transformer today and you order it and then you put it in, you know, X months later and everything's fine and you got the rest of the grid to make up with it. You know, you can reroute stuff, you got redundancy in the system. If you're flying these transformers all over the place with an EMP, you lost your redundancy. The entire grid's down. Oh, yeah, there's also, that's one of the most vulnerable things. It's the most hard to place. There's also something that's called a SCADA, Supervisor Control and Data Acquisition. A computer, it's kind of like something called a primary logic computer. People work in the industry know what that is. But so these things control, provide the electronic controls for the grid, and they were expected to fry too. But it's the transformers I worry most about just because they're so huge, they're so big, they weigh 200 to 400 tons. They're as big as a house. There's unlike only a half a dozen rail cars that can move them, a half a dozen truck trailers that can move them. And, you know, it would, and the production of them, it's like it at a rate of producing that would be commensurate to just a normal grid growth, maybe a few replacements. There's not much in the worry of replacement. These things do typically last a long time unless you get some novice design. They're all hand wound by experts. South Africa had a solar storm. They got a bunch of their transformers. Some of their transformers, they thought, well, we'll just do our own. But their guys weren't. The artist is doing this, and those transformers only lasted about 3 years. They fried. Mm-hmm. So this is a very crucial piece of our infrastructure, and what a lot of people don't realize is a lot of the electric current that's going to fry these things actually comes up through the ground tap. So you need surge blockers on the center tap, on the ground tap of these transformers. That's your main protection, actually. This signal travels to the ground. And all these people buying this stuff to protect their home, and they say, oh, we're going to shut the signal on the ground. Well, I think that's hilarious. But anyway, what you're buying is a cheap lightning surge protector at best. That's my humble opinion. But so I'd be very careful with this stuff. And what good's your home? You know, you might keep your home from burning. If you had something to stop a signal like that, maybe you can keep your home from burning down. But my faith and confidence is not in that stuff. Anyway, what, that's another story.
What was, you know, back in, I guess, the 50s when they were setting off all the nuclear tests in Nevada, they must have learned a lot about EMPs during that time. And were they just far enough out in the desert where it didn't really affect anything on the ground? Because obviously...
Altitude of burst and things like that. Yeah, it affected areas right around them. But that's also what we know, that if you set it off real close to the ground, you will get EMP effect.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely. But there is some mitigating aspects in the atmosphere that tamp it down some, as opposed to if you set it off at about 30 kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
You will get an EMP effect. There will be an EMP, but it will not be as powerful for the yield of the weapon as it would be if you do it at altitude.
Right.
Okay. So there's various atmospheric effects that mitigate it if you fire it low. But it's still an EMP, and it can still fire the devil out of stuff. In fact, when I was in the military, they taught us to disconnect completely. They have one radio system completely disconnected and locked up in Faraday cage. Because, you know, they taught us that even if you had the switches turned off, the EMP would jump the switch gap. You had to have it completely disconnected. You couldn't just throw switches off, not even the handbreaker switches. You might have seen these videos of these power stations when they throw the switches. They got these switch arms that open up and they go through the air and they move like 40 feet. And they're carrying this long bolt of lightning with them because the current don't want to stop. It's got, you know, inductance. It don't want to stop at first. It takes quite a throw to stop that current flow.
Right.
And, you know, it's just like a spark gap. And if you ever see a spark gap system, some of these spark gaps have got a good distance between the two sides, anode, cathode, whatever you want to call them, and that spark gap jumps. That's another reason. That and voltage division. Well, anybody that knows electrical engineering knows what voltage division is, and that's another reason. But even if you had to shunt the ground, and if that's all you had to worry about, it's not going to be a perfect system. So, yeah, well, I'm
I think most people
that.
Listening to this, if they thought that it wasn't going to be a big deal, most of the things that you've talked about, you know, we don't deal with this. I mean, we just don't deal with this in everyday life. So you look at it and you go, if there isn't a really good quality plan, we are all in deep, deep trouble. We're going to come back with our guest, Greg Allison. He's going to talk to us a little bit, too, later on about the National Space Society's policy committee that he's been working on here to harden the power grid. We've got a lot of stuff to cover. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Spacemen, planets, and lunar surface, here I come. Here I come. Loose balloon, how high can you fly? You're a loose balloon before you pop and you die. Loose balloon, you made that little kid cry when you took off for the sun. You took off for sun. People squint to look up just to see you fly away.
To the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
What do you have for us, Bill?
Well, we have a sponsor this hour, Pape Machinery.
No. Really?
No, really.
Okay.
Yeah. And they're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. And they'll take care of you with any of your John Deere products. If you need a mower, a tractor, implements, you need service parts, they do it all up there. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. Go up and see them. Or you can give them a call, 226-9226. And they'll be glad to take care of you. Or you can catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Yeah. Ta-da! And let's see. Today is June 11th, 2023. And, you know, it's interesting. Our guest, Greg Allison, I thought, what great timing, because the Chinese spy balloon thing, how long ago was that? That was a little bit ago. But everybody looked at that. And people had different reactions, you know, hey, we should shoot it out of the sky. Why is it flying over the country? Are they taking pictures? What's going on? If you're just joining us, you should listen to the hour just before this one, and then you'll realize that actually, like, balloons are more treacherous than we thought.
Much bigger threat than we thought.
Liam and I were talking in the break, and I'm like, you know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of, like, the homicide deal. You know, they always say more homicides are committed by hammers than guns. I mean, hammers are the weapon of choice because everybody has one. But who thinks of, you know, when you go out in your garage, you see the hammer, you don't go, oh, God, look out, there's the hammer.
Hide
you know,
the hammer.
Look out, the hammer. But it's like, you know, oh, there's a balloon flying over. Oh, I wonder what that's all about. And everybody just stared at it. So Greg, was that like the hammer? I mean, was the balloon...
Well, funny you should mention hammers. I keep a big hammer in my car.
See?
Right next to my driver's seat. And I can drive on base with it, and nobody will say a thing, because the hammer's not a weapon.
See? I'm telling you. It's
full
the...
auto. A hammer is full auto. It's got an infinite magazine. It's got a built-in silencer. The only racket is from the victim going...
Well, they come in different calibers, too, so, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, I got a large bore, full automatic, infinite magazine hammer next to my seat in my car.
See?
Thor would be proud.
I rest my case. But it's
talking
like,
about asymmetric weapons. That,
there you go.
Perfect segue. I love it.
That's the one. it's kind of funny, though, because when people saw the balloon, they thought, you know, it's a nothing burger. And now all this stuff you're telling us, and it's like, oh, crap, we should have been terrified.
Bingo, exactly. I mean, you know, oh, it's a balloon. It's a party balloon. It's fun. It's a party, you know.
Yeah.
Well, and sadly, I think that the Air Force actually did shoot down a party balloon. It was an A-9 missile.
An expensive balloon.
It belonged to the Northern Illinois Amateur Balloon Organization.
Oh, crap.
That you know, one of my best friends wrote the software that was controlling that balloon.
It identified it as a non-threatening balloon, and look what happened.
I broke the news on that. On my YouTube channels, I broke the news on that before anybody got out there. I broke the news on that balloon as a party balloon because I knew where it came from. At first, I didn't say whose it was because they wanted to be quiet until the FBI knocked on their door.
Uh-oh.
They were looking for. But I've got a couple YouTube channels that a lot of people look at. Green Greg's is my prepping channel. Started out as an urban gardening channel, but when the people asked me to do a power grid defense video, because then discovered I'd run a party, they discovered I had chaired a couple power grid defense conferences, and suddenly all these preppers joined my channel, and it changed the character of my channel. So what everybody wants to hear is what's going on in the world. So I cover a lot of topics about what's going on in the world, so you might want to bring me on here again to watch my channel. You might want to bring me on some more, like the AI topic where you had it was in the news segment that followed this, that they were talking about how they had a church sermon that was written by ChatGPT. And it just strikes me kind of odd that you would have an unliving, unaware chatbot write a sermon, and then people would go there and use that for their spiritual fulfillment, you know. Well, these language models are really good at putting together words based over searching everything on the Internet and all the written documents, which they can do that like almost instantly. But there is no real intelligence there. It's not what we would call intelligence. It is algorithmic word association and assemblances that is brilliant and looks intelligent from our limited standpoint, but really and truly is not yet intelligent. It's definitely not sentient. So that would be leading a spiritual exercise is kind of, wow. You know, I'm sure it was good words because it's going to string together the best words you're going to find that, you know, that could be done in the algorithmic approach. In my college career back many decades ago, studied how to design computers, and I know that the core of a computer is something called arithmetic logic unit, and the only thing it can do, we call it adding ones and zeros, but really it's just correlating high and low voltages through these things called registers, which are latches made from that latch a bit in a higher low state, and they're just an assembly of a few transistors. And so with these transistors, they got people thinking that that we're doing sophisticated math. All they can do, though, is add mathematically. But it's really the voltage correlation process. You do it many times, it's called multiplication. If you add a negative number, it's called subtraction. If you do it many times, it's called division. And somewhere on this, based on a simple application of what you're doing in arithmetic logic, you know, we've come up with all the simulations, all the video, everything we know on the Internet, that's its origin, which is really nothing. But that we could have a sentient system out of that, it's kind of mind-boggling to me. Maybe at some higher level we'll one day have systems that they'd have to have sensors and all of the kind of things to become aware of the world around, which they don't have yet. But we're a long way off from a truly sentient, really understanding system. It doesn't mean that you won't have a system that won't have threatening algorithms. That's possible. But the thing I worry about is not the AI. It's the man behind the curtain. Somebody's controlling this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the thing I would worry about the most, the man behind the curtain. And that's also part of our AI arms race with China in particular. And there is a man behind the curtain on there. His name is Xi Jinping, and then he's got his minions, who aren't as fun as the minions on that cartoon show that some of us love to talk about.
Because they were fun.
Yeah, those were fun. And also Sweet Home Alabama played in that show. But you led off with here. So we've done mentioned two shows in the course of our conversation that pertain to the topic at hand.
Of course.
So,
well, you know, what is it? Life imitates art, right?
No kidding. Well, the scary thing about this, talking about asymmetry, is these balloons are cheap. You know, you mentioned in your intro to me that I did a balloon launch return vehicle, did a flight program on a Phase 1 SBR. Phase 1 SBR is only $70,000. That is intended to be a paper study for you to propose to do a hardware study. We did a hardware program. We built the balloon launch return vehicle. We actually built a subscale version of it and flew it. We did three rocket motor test stand firings to characterize the fuel grain we would use. We did. We hired Lockheed Martin to run an aero analysis for us. And that cost about $14,000. I got it real cheap. I had a buddy over at Lockheed who was one of the top managers, and he was gung-ho for helping us out. Dave Christensen, he's passed away now, God rest his soul. Great man. But he helped us out with that, and we got aero analysis run to optimize the shape of our wing body on this vehicle, and we had ground stations built. You know, I rented a boat and on the spot market to go out and launch this thing from Louisiana. And one of these, now I used to use the, I think I used a supply boat that occasion. I used a utility boat to launch a bigger rocket later, which is a smaller boat. Like I said, you can do small boats. We did all this, and I bought the balloon, which was about back then about $10,000. I bought the helium, and we did all this for $70,000. And then I did a bigger program called the Cat's Prize Rocket after that. And we did that for something on the order of $150,000. Now, this was, you know, 25, 23 years ago. But still, when you think about it, this is a fraction of the cost of an AIM-9 missile to put up a very sophisticated, the Cat's Prize rocket. We actually come up with a way to defeat what the GPS system had on then to keep you from flying missiles with the GPS. They had something called COCOM limits that would limit your ability to detect your travels with your GPS device if it was at above a certain altitude and going beyond a certain velocity. Well, you could get one, a waiver on one, but not another. So we got the altitude waiver, and then we figured out how through putting a 1 pulse per second oven control oscillator stable frequency that we output from our rocket to ground stations, we could actually track our rocket using the GPS to initiate the system. And have perfect reporting. So we had to figure out how, you know, all the other countries weren't supposed to be able to do this. So working out of a garage with a few guys working part-time, that's what we were. We're engineers working on the side. This is a side venture for us. But I did pay people full-time on the Cat's Prize. I had paid labor. And we did all that for $150,000. And we went out 200 miles out in the Gulf of Mexico on a utility boat known as the Mr. Offshore. I don't know if that boat's still in service now. Captain Blackman, I forget now, ran that boat. But anyway, we could have hit Havana, Cuba with that thing. That thing was designed to be able to go 100 kilometers. It would only take three of those to cover the entire continent of the United States. So I would expect, and what we expect, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry used to teach us, was that the enemy would hit us with a multi-pronged attack. If they were going to hit us, they wouldn't do just one thing. They would do several. They would have these hacking attacks. It would probably start with a major hacking attack. And then we saw in the Metcalf station in near San Jose back in April, I think it was April 16, 2013, somebody went in and shot up this substation, but they were really smart. They knew exactly what to shoot at. They didn't take it up to actually take it down. It was as if it was a dry run of practice. They actually cut. They went in the facility. They cut the fiber optic communications cable, and they got out of there before anybody got there. And to this date, we don't know who did it. But on the very same day that occurred was the first day that the North Korean satellite flew over Washington, D.C. And at the same time, unbeknownst to us, the North Koreans had this boat called the Chungcheong, which is just a big supply boat. It's a small cargo boat, actually. We call them a tramp steamer, running around in either the Caribbean or the Gulf of Mexico with an ISIL shipping container with two fully erect missiles on missile launchers in that shipping container.
Wow.
So they could have done a multi-pronged attack on us, and it might have been a dry run for all these. And we know that they're huge on hacking because they're hacking. They fund their system with hacking, with hacking crypto coin and things like that. That's how they fund their technology development over North Korea. They cyber attack and steal. And so if you look at that, to think that we're not vulnerable is crazy. And we also know that Donald Trump passed an executive order to prevent us from having Chinese-made components in our critical power grid systems. And for some strange reason, on day one in his office, Joe B. rescinded that executive order.
Wow.
And we don't know the full nature of what they got, but we know that Sandia National Laboratory or somebody is tearing into one of these, and they found some stuff that is highly alarming. So we believe that they've got direct cell phone technology, black box technology, and a lot of these systems are selling us that could probably just, they wouldn't even have to hack it. They already got access to it. They could probably fry our systems that way. So we got so many vulnerabilities that it is not funny. One thing people, I believe we can defeat a lot of this stuff. We can deal with it. But people also need to prepare. They need to get ready for the worst of times. I cover that a lot on my Green Greg's channel. I got another channel called Galactic Greg's and all these balloon videos, because I got so many videos on Green Greg's, it might be easier to find some of my balloon videos on Galactic Greg's. Although the one you posted, I don't think I put that on, maybe I have. Yeah, that is on Galactic Greg's too. Okay. So Galactic Greg's, now there's more than one Galactic Greg's channel. Mine don't have apostrophe S. Mine is just Jerry G.S. There's one with two G's on the end. There's one, I don't know, some preacher started a channel after I did, and he don't have the S. It's just Galactic Greg's. So you got to search for Galactic Greg's, Jerry G.S., no apostrophe. The apostrophe is a comic book channel, of all things. Anyway, I'm not into comic books. So, yeah, we need to.
He's got time for that. You're dealing with dangerous balloons. Doesn't that seem weird? I mean, you think the guy who works with balloons all the time, he should have time for comic books. But this whole topic is just so incredibly complicated. I mean, most people
would make for a comic book, a good comic book series.
It would.
I'm playing around the idea of writing a little novel.
I think you should.
Somebody thwarting one of these balloon attacks.
Maybe we'd be slightly smarter about it. We wouldn't be mocking about it. We have to take a really quick break.
I think I'm making a precursor to another novel project that started a few years ago. Then I'm giving an excuse to finish that project.
That's what we all need is a novel to have an excuse to finish the other novel that we were working on. That's actually a good reason just, you know, not to do a lot of chores, actually. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Greg Allison.
How busy I am.
I can only imagine. All you do is search you on the internet, and it's like your computer just starts to smoke. You're a busy guy. We'll be right back. You can find all this information at wethepeopleradio.us.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. And let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana message. Don't buy the corporate marijuana lies whose end game is to not pay any taxes. California has failed to control the grows. Dispensaries are selling out the back door as well as selling other illicit substances. Do we really need the damage to the environment, suicide, schizophrenia, hyperemesis, cardiac events in elderly users, drug driving crashes, genetic damage, pulmonary damage, neonatal low birth weight, and lost IQ for our youth? No, we don't. Remember, let's be careful out there.
Woke up this morning with light in my eyes, and then realized it was still dark outside. It was a light coming down from the sky. I don't know who or why. Must be those strangers that come every night. Those saucer-shaped lights put people uptight. Leave blue-green footprints that glow in the dark. I hope they get home all right. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?
The birds, they knew what we'd be talking about. Okay, so the men here had questions.
Hey, I wondered if you could go back and touch a little bit more on the types of payloads that the Chinese have already developed or are under development. I know in your video you talked about some of the rocket propelled planes, bio weapons, the different types of things that they could attach to these balloons.
Yes, they They have flown on, now, a zero-pressure balloon, the kind I was talking about, I thought they would actually do an attack from for an EMP launched offshore, because they're cheaper, they fly higher, they're easier to deal with than the super-pressure balloons. Now, let me go back. I'm going to distinguish one thing. Super-pressure balloons are good for long-duration missions. They can fly for months. If you want to launch it from China, it's a perfect platform. If you want to launch it offshore, something you're going to detonate, you'll use a zero-pressure balloon. Now, from zero-pressure balloons, they have flown packages that had multiple flight vehicles that you drop attached to them. And these were glide vehicles, and they looked like they were set up to have a rocket motor in, like my balloon launch return vehicle. These were like miniature versions of their hypersonic DF-17 weapon system, which, by the way, DF-17 can carry nuclear weapons. And the Chinese have just stabilized a new explosive, I don't know, it was a CL-20 or something. I've got to go back and research that. They've got a very high explosive. It's kind of like nitroglycerin, but it's unstable. They've stabilized it. And it's a very extreme high explosive. So China has got a lot of stuff in the repertoire for weapon systems. But they practiced a launch of this stuff. And they had three different styles, versions, designs of this glide vehicle. So they were trying to optimize, doing an actual test to figure out which one performed best. So they're already testing platforms to launch from balloons that give you cross range. If one thing I didn't say or fully spell out is those higher altitude winds, and you know, there's a season where they all blow from west to east, just like the normal jet stream. But there's something called turnaround where they stop. You can launch a balloon straight up and let it hover. And that has applications, too. It's actually a good attack time. It's about the time it's perfect for going over the Chinese Strait. If you wanted to go somewhere, you just drop altitude a little bit and catch a wind that's moving, drop some ballast or let some gas loose or something like that. You know, if you're going to go up, drop ballast. If you're going to go down, release some gas. But they could actually control which way they're going by catching the right wind, but they could hover almost for a while. Now, if you are launching in the summer at the higher altitude, you'll go from east to west at the stratospheric altitudes that I'm talking about, you know, 80 to 120, 140,000 feet. So if they want to maximize just drift over the east coast, they might do it in the summertime. If they want to be able to hit all the coasts without needing some directional assist, they would do it in the turnaround season. If they want to drift over from the west coast, most of the year, rest of the year, it's good for that. So, but if you're on the coast where the wind's blowing away from the coast, still, if you launch it early, get a little bit closer in the coast, and especially if you use something like my balloon launch return vehicle or that DF-17-looking thing they had, or any kind of rocket like my Cat's Prize rocket, they could get altitude and cross range. And like I said, three Cat's Prize-type rockets they could hit. You know, you can cover the entire continent of the United States, launch one from the West Coast, one from the East Coast, one from the Gulf Coast. So I would expect they would launch a few balloons. If you had, like, two ships off each thing, you could totally cover the coastal areas with EMPs from the 30-kilometer altitude or a little higher. I think they would go to 120,000 feet, actually. So, but if you launch from... we see stuff still come from China, but at least with them we got time to sit, but it's still going to be harder to get. That's where you may want to use your Aegis or something like that. But Aegis is very expensive. I think I'm going off on the tangent. Your original question was?
Oh, just the different types of weapons that they could.
Oh, yeah, different types of weapons. So they have practiced drop-in drone swarms. Now, drone swarms could attack troops on the ground directly. You could attack armored vehicles. You see drones in use in the Ukraine to much advantage in taking out armored weapon systems, ships, smaller ships. You wouldn't take an aircraft carrier out with that, but you might with something that looks like a DF-17. If they're in a theater of combat, like our aircraft carriers want to be far enough off that we think they're fairly safe, but they got to be close enough that we got range to get our aircraft to the target areas that if we were fighting China, Taiwan. And so the problem is their DF 19, 18 missiles, they can actually, DF 21, they can actually reach twice the distance of our aircraft. So we are vulnerable where their aircraft carriers needing to get inside that missile range. Now, we think, okay, well, we got a phalanx of different weapons that we can use to take these missiles out and come in. But they've already, China just did an exercise where they did three volleys at our aircraft carriers, and they believe we can totally exhaust all of our countermeasures and take out the aircraft carrier. But we are counting on, well, they won't find us because we move fast, and by the time the weapon gets to us, the aircraft carrier will be somewhere else. But the problem is, if you launch a weapon from a balloon, it knows where you're at already. It's already seeing you. And second most, that balloon is a recon balloon, could actually identify your exact location, and even if you move and zigzag, it could send update coordinates to that carrier killer missile that's coming in from the Chinese mainland. So that gives them a decided advantage in the battlefield to being able to take out our carriers. Our carriers are at grave risk in a war with Taiwan. We need to reconsider this because they've got the weapon systems to exhaust most of our onboard systems, and their practice run had them taking out the entire escort fleet and the carrier. So all the destroyers, everything in the entire carrier group is what the Chinese are practicing to take out. And they believe they've developed the means to do that. And in my humble opinion, they didn't say this or advertise it, but I think the balloons may be a key component of that in identifying the location, targeting, and providing target update data to any incoming missiles, and perhaps even missiles to strike with from the and then all the, you know, they may go for the Aegis destroyers themselves with those things and leave the bigger ones for the aircraft carrier. So our entire carrier group is at risk, and these kind of weapon systems would play a, from a balloon, could play a big role in that, and also against ground forces. In here in the United States, they could attack our military bases, key components of it. You know, that spy balloon probably told them where a lot of our key communication systems were, and because they had intel reconnaissance that could pick up all these signals. The kind of signals that, capabilities they had, they could tell who our commanders were when they were using their cell phones and maybe even figure out where some of these people would be located, what their routines are. They could target individuals if they have the right kind of intelligence systems. And I would expect if they were tackling them, we may have some spy balloons over the country at that point, too, possibly. So it's what they could do from these. And weapons release, the United States back in the late 40s and 50s was practicing, and I show a couple of different, very different approaches the United States used back then for practicing releasing rust spores that could take out your wheat crops. There's also a black fungus that can take out your corn crops. China has probably also practiced the same kind of thing. If it take out our power, take out our crops, America would be devastated. You know, I think the actual fatalities would be worse than what the EMP Commission to the Congress reported back when they said 9 out of 10 people would be lost due to societal collapse. So they did not take into account biological attacks. They did not take into account what would happen with the spent fuel rod pulls at the nuclear power plants. We'd like to think the reactors, we could save them. But what you're going to have problems with is we got actually far more radioactive material sitting in the cooling pools, which are outside the containment building of these nuclear power plants. Far more radioactive material. These are in the forms of the fuel rods. When it's still hot, they have to be put in the pools. Well, the pools are normally covered with 20 foot of water, and we got backup generators to cool them, so we think everything is cool. But in a grid down situation, you're not going to have the fuel to bring the fuel to the generators to keep them running. They evaporate at least 160 gallons a minute out of these pools.
Wow.
And even though they're covered with 20 foot of water, it's just a matter of days before it evaporates. The problem with these hot fuel rods are they have a zirconium alloy cladding on them. Metal would be too brittle, most metal, so they use this zirconium. It's called zircaloid. Unfortunately, when this zircaloid is hot, it will be hot. It burns on contact with air. And so I've had a nuclear engineer argue, oh, that don't happen. I got zircaloid sitting on my desk. Yeah, well, sure, you can, because that's not what's been in a nuclear plant. But the Sandia National Laboratories did some test runs on this, and those things burnt slap up. I got the reports. I got the pictures, the photos, the data, and that stuff burnt slap up. So what's going to happen is this stuff will, and if you had a nuclear war, everybody thinks how bad a nuclear war would be, but most of the radiation will be died off in 2 weeks. You know, the radiation dies down pretty fast. You get some nasty stuff like your strontium-90, which will still be laying around for a good time, and that goes into your bones. If you ingest it, it will because it has an affinity for calcium. It's on the same series of periodic table, and it would stay in your bones and radiate you forever, as long as you're alive. Well, at least not forever, but it's a lifelong affliction if you pick that stuff up. But there's ways to mitigate that. There's ways to not get into that. But still, most radiation's gone in 2 weeks, except now with the nuclear power plants, they spent fuel rod pools. They could be gassing the stuff up in the atmosphere for years. Years. So you got to deal with years and years of output out of this pool, this stuff, you know, sitting in a slag in the bottom, burning and smoldering, and putting this radiation all over the place. It would be extremely nasty. I think that is going to add significantly to the death toll. And another thing they didn't count on, they thought all the farmers grew enough food to feed themselves. They did back when I was a kid. When I was a kid, every farmer had a huge garden. But now most of them don't. And most of them are growing market stuff they sell from the market, not to grow from themselves. And so you'll find maybe a few little garden patches here and there. I did a video where I drove through South Georgia and here over North Alabama, very rural areas, just counting farmhouses, and I would drive for miles and not see a single garden. And I backed that up by looking from Google Earth. So this whole idea that people are not resilient, people are not prepared for what's to come. Well, you need to grow a garden. And also show leaves, and you need heirloom seeds because you got to harvest. You ain't gonna be able to go to the store anymore, so you need to have seeds that you can actually reap, harvest the seeds and replant them and get the same seed back. Hybrid right. plants, because you built for big hybrid tomatoes, will not work. You're gonna get some gnarly thing back. So you need good seed, that are open source pollinated, air pollinated heirloom seeds. And I got a couple of vendors that I use, I'm affiliate market with. It's on my list on a lot of my videos of True Leaf Market and Eden Brothers. And it helps me if people go use my links. They won't pay a penny more for them. But those are the kind of seeds you need to plant. You need to grow. I got videos on my channel showing you how to grow a garden, how to prepare the beds. You won't be able to go to the store to buy fertilizers, buy plants. None of the stuff you like to go to the store to help you with the garden, they won't be able to do. But with worm products, you can actually mitigate that by making your own worm tea, but worm castings. You don't need artificial fertilizers in it, so I don't use any of that at all. I use no chemicals in my growing at all. Everything I grow is pure natural, organic, beyond organic, because organic allows you to use a lot of stuff that I don't use. I'm totally natural in the way I grow stuff. So get worms. Sometimes I sell worms. I'm not selling. At the moment, I might resume it. But if I don't, I will put other links eventually to other places for people to get these. You need to look at our nation needs to become resilient. We need to be self-reliant. And individuals need to become self-reliant. Homestead is very important. This is how a rocket scientist become a worm farmer, by the way. I realize that's important for self. I realize the threats our society faces. I was able to analyze that and go, holy smoke. Fortunately, I grew up on a farm. So I'm a redneck and a rocket scientist all combined in one, which gives me some unique capabilities here. Redneck rocket scientist, you know. So, you know, I know about farming, hunting, trapping, fishing, and country boy can't survive kind of, you know, Hank Williams Jr. kind of attitude.
if we did have an EMP, what effect does an EMP have on the ozone layer?
Well, it wouldn't so much be the EMP in that case, but that be the actual nuclear burst itself. It can disrupt the ozone. If you have enough, of these, if you had a several nukes set off, you would definitely damage the ozone layer. And that's, and they claim that even a small exchange of a nuclear warlock, maybe in between India and Pakistan, would great damage to ozone layer. A full-scale nuclear war, it may be a several EMP devices could do some, but a full-scale nuclear war would devastate the ozone layer. It wouldn't totally wipe it out, but it would wipe it out so bad that you would get cancers and sunburn and stuff like that if you were outside in the heat of the day, anywhere. You wouldn't want to be outside except maybe early in the morning or late in the afternoon when the sun angle for the atmosphere is long. You know, nocturnal mammals. You'll want to be almost nocturnal. You'd want to stay indoors, but that's going to devastate crops. You need to have seeds in storage. You need to buy extra seeds and store them, so because that was the ozone would replenish in time. It'll take a few years, so you need to think like Joseph, and back in the days of when he was in Egypt, storing food for 7 years. You need to store food and store seeds. We're in the good times. Bad times could be coming, and they can last several years. So maybe that was a object lesson to us for what could be bad times around the corner. And, with the tensions with China over Taiwan, with the tensions we got with Iran, with the tensions we got with Russia, this idea that these couldn't do this. Look, I did this stuff. I did these balloon operations as an amateur group operating on my spare time. Out of a shoestring budget, I found it exceedingly easy to do. So actually, terrorist groups, if they could get their hands somehow on some of these loose nukes, and we were told that some of these backpack nukes that Russia had have come up missing. We were told there were like 80 of them that they had pre-planted in the United States at one time. That came out. So there's a lot of stuff that just isn't talked about. There are some other nuclear devices that are missing. And we don't know what happened when the Soviet Union fell apart, and they had no physical security on a lot of their nuclear materials, nuclear sites. It's been rumored that Iran actually got two full-blown launchers from Kazakhstan before Kazakhstan gave up their nukes. That's a rumor that I've heard from a couple of different sources, and one I heard years ago, and I've heard it confirmed more recently. I heard two originally. I've heard it was a little bit more since then. So I don't know what's the real case on that. Rumors and rumors of war, rumors and bloomers, they both stink, He says we can't have a little fun. If you don't laugh at doomsday, you're going to cry.
Well, that's the thing. You can't get too, and I think that's why your YouTube channels, as you've been saying them, I've been adding them to the page so that people will have them. It's good to have people who know what's going on, but people who aren't so... far into it that they can't even, they can't convey a thought because they're just so angry or scared or
more
whatever.
Bad news.
More bad news.
Here's my approach. I don't think there's anything we can't solve. I'm an engineer. We live by trying to solve stuff. You see a problem, how do you fix it? Whether it's either a problem that you fix through engineering or a problem you fix politically. I'm the oddball engineer in that most engineers abhor politics, but I've also had to understand that everything starts with policy decisions in the government. And a lot of people, especially in my prepper community, see the government as being totally against us, but still, no matter how myopic they may be, those politicians want to vote, just like that song by Charlie Daniels of saying the politician wants another vote. What was the name of that song? Anyway, that aside, brain lock here. The situation is that we can have impact on them, even if they want to go a different direction. We can still drive it some because they still want to do whatever they got to do to get that vote. So if they see a groundswell of public opinion, they're going to have to move to it. And I found that small organizations can have an outsized impact on Congress, and I discovered that back in the years when I was chairman of the policy committee of the National Space Society, and even prior to that, when I ran the phone tree of the National Space Society, we had major impacts on votes. At the old Five Society, when they had only 5,000 members, kept the United States from signing what was known as the Moon Treaty, which the Carter administration and State Department were backing. And we saw this as being an anathema to the ability of private enterprise to ever develop space. We never thought the government would ever have deep enough coffers to really develop it. And why do you want to develop space? Because you need your eggs in more than one basket.
Yeah.
The whole idea was
you guys were right on that.
In space, permanently in space habitats, kind of like Elon talks about, but we were a little bit beyond that. There was a guy named Gerard Philomel had this notion for rotating free-floating habitats. You've probably seen Jeff Bezos actually picked that up, showed some of his video not too long ago. But this is not a Bezos concept. It started with Gerard K. O'Neill in the 1970s.
Hold that thought, Greg, because we should. I can see Bill's percolating five questions. I can see them on his face. We will do them right away when we come back. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Against the sky of doom, tell me you see them. 'Cause what's inside of me is invisible to most, even in clear view.
I'm sending out a signal to the possibility of you, 'cause right at this moment
I know you're connected to a part of me that I don't even know myself.
Hey, Greg, before we run out of time, I understand you had some involvement in the Artemis program. Can you talk to us about that?
Yes, I was a system safety engineer for avionics, an avionics system safety engineer on that program. So I've worked a lot of space. My career has been aerospace. My career has been engineering. My career has been electrical engineering, robotic systems engineering, and system safety, especially in the area of avionics. So I'm an avionics subject matter expert with regards to system safety. So there's probably some things that I probably shouldn't talk about on that project. So there's some things that do concern me, you know, having seen how the sausage is made. But we did have a successful mission. Rockets are risky. Long ago, when I was developing my own rockets, I came up with what I call Allison's Laws of Rockets. I say rockets go boom. That's law one. Law two, rockets have always gone boom. And law three, rockets always will go boom. Our job is to make them go boom less often, to make them safer. One thing to bear in mind is reliability is inversely proportional to parts count. Of course, you want redundant systems to give you more parts to increase safety, though. But so it kind of goes against, but it's a little different function, design margin, things like that. So, when I look at it, a rocket's got 33 rocket engines under it, and it's the most powerful booster. It's got like twice the power of the fuel of the Saturn V. That thing scares me. But, you know, like the space starship that Elon Musk launched, you know, that thing is a beast. The N-1 rocket that the Russians built detonated at the pad and flung a considerable debris for 6 miles.
Wow.
So one of those to go off near Boca Chica, it would take you out Port Isabel, just north of it. Well, not take it out, but it would throw a lot of stuff up there. So they need to be very careful. They need to take those things out to sea to launch, in my humble opinion. They've got a couple of barges, which are not barges. They've got a couple of oil platforms they could do this from. Hopefully they will transition to that soon. Because, you know, they're still in the development phase, and that's where you got most of your mishaps is while you're in development phase. I've got great hope for their system, though, because it could lower launch costs to being dirt cheap. It would greatly open the frontiers for what can be done in space if the Starship can pull off a fraction of their objectives. So I've got great hope there, but with great hope, there's also great peril, and I hope they pay attention to that and more attention. The problem with any engineered system is the people that build it, to them it's their baby, and their baby's beautiful, and there's nothing wrong with it because we did everything to fix it. But they tend to overlook a lot of things that they should not otherwise overlook. People that develop a system think in success space, this is why it's going to work. People like me think in failure space, this is why it's not going to work, this is where it can go wrong, and here's what you need to do about it. And you go about the engineering and think, how do you fix it? So I get focused on that kind of stuff. And it's kind of the same way with our power grid. It's kind of the same way with the vulnerabilities of our civilization across the spectrum, food supply, power. You have a lot of advertising for agriculture, so you know I do some videos on food supply issues, supply chain issues. All these things count. They all matter for the state of the security of our society, and we've got to start paying more attention to it because we have normalcy bias, and we think that everything is going to continue as is. The truth of the matter is nothing ever continues as is. Everything changes. So normalcy bias is very myopic. It's short-sighted. We've got to be able to think ahead and correctly anticipate what could go wrong. For example, Fukushima, well, you know, these burn walls are high enough. We're good. It's supposed to be good for a 1,000-year earthquake, but they didn't really research in time and look at the marker. They didn't believe the markers their ancestors left on the hillsides around and said, don't blow this marker. And when they had that tsunami in March 2011, it overswept the berms and took out those backup generators. Thankfully for Japan, they had fire trucks and the entire system went down like a nationwide EMP would give you. And so they were able to at least keep the spent fuel rods cool by pumping water on them from the fire trucks. And you go to Zaporizhia right now, the water level, you know, somehow they didn't think that dam would ever break. Duh. Well, the dam is broke, and now the water level is below the intakes of the water to pump water on the spent fuel rods they got there. They've got a problem because also they're dealing with power outages there. They have, and I've done some videos on this on my channel, they're dealing with power outages, and they're in a war zone. So having the ability just to pump fuel to get the diesel fuel to the backup generators is problematic, and those backup generators are supposed to be pumping water out of the lake that ain't there anymore. So can they have enough fire trucks to keep those huge pools clean, get enough water to them? They don't have as big a trucks as we got here in America. The tanker trucks are not as big. They don't even have semi-trucks like we have here. I've been to Moscow. And I didn't see, I've been all over the streets and highways around Moscow traveling around, and I did not see a single semi-truck the entire thing time I was there. Basically, you'd see something like a 2-ton truck, maybe 2.5-ton truck, with a tarp over the back, you know, like military trucks here. Yeah. That was their primary mode of moving cargo around. It's nothing like we got over here. They just don't have the systems, the infrastructure. And so they're going to be very, very challenged to keep that place from irradiating a lot of Russia and Europe. So I'm really concerned about that right now. I'm saying, you know, it could be done, but they need to make it a priority and jump through hoops to make sure that they can do this. And they got to be really smart in the middle of the war zone. I'm not sure if they're smart enough or resilient enough to do what they got to do. Time will tell.
Yeah.
But we got a lot of risk in society. We're just not thinking things through well enough, ahead enough. And you need to get more safety professionals involved in things like that. You know, my rockets I developed, launched altitude balloons, were air-launched hybrid rockets, just like Spaceship One, which won the Katz Prize. I mean, not the Katz Prize, the X Prize, which I actually was a competitor in also. But a lot of my guys worked on that. They used the technology from this HART Katz Prize rocket to help work that system. So I got a rocket motor sitting here next to just next to my knee that I use as a computer stand. That was the daddy, basically, of the Starship, not Starship, the Spaceship One motor, or the granddaddy of the Spaceship Two motor. One of my good friends died in the cold flow test of that. So you say I had a friend die in a static discharge, probably, or over temperature, supercritical situation, and a cold flow test, which most people don't think of a cold flow test. It's just things you don't think about to get you. That cost 3 lives. And they've already lost 4 lives in the Virgin Galactic venture.
Right.
One being, you know, the guy pulled the handle accidentally that caused the shuttlecock mechanism that was supposed to feather the craft for re-entry upon ascent launch, and the thing just broke apart. One guy survived that, and that's a miracle. One of the pilots actually survived that. But you know,
how much bigger is that Musk rocket than like the Saturn?
It's twice as big as the Saturn V.
Is it really?
M1. It's got twice as much fuel as the Saturn V. The Saturn V or N1 rocket, if they go off, are like a small nuke.
Yeah, they're huge.
It's twice as big. It's got a lot of fuel. So
wow.
It can have a really, you know, when you saw it detonate up over the ocean, over the Gulf of Mexico, it depleted most of its fuel. That was, you know, it was a good thing, you know. And, you know.
And that was planned, though.
The heck out of the, huh?
That was planned, though, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, it's part of the flight termination system. They terminated that flight because they couldn't get the thing to stage.
Right.
You know, critical events like staging are where you have a lot of accidents because, you know, a lot of things have to happen. You got to work exactly right. A rocket is like a chain. Every link has got to be good for it not to go boom.
Right.
A really long chain.
I didn't realize it was that much.
Reliability.
I didn't realize it was that big.
Do what?
I say I didn't realize it was that much bigger.
Yeah, it's huge. It's a beast. If Musk believes that he could, at least from his operating point, his operating cost, he can fly those things once he gets them turning around and launch for like $9 a pound to orbit. We're talking... you would be able to fly to Mars for something like buying a really nice home on Earth.
Wow.
You'll have to pay. You'll have to work most of your life to be able to pay for it. But it's the same level and scale that our earlier ancestors settled America. They had to save. They came over and they worked for indentured servants for maybe 10 or 15 years, basically slaves, to pay off their transit to come here. But it's the same order of, so space colonization, I'm not sure Mars is really the best target, but, you know, I'm in favor of those free-floating habitats that you manufacture when you have the controlled environment of one gravity and Earth-like environment inside of it. It takes a little bit longer to build that, but you could build smaller versions of that. Years ago, I come up with a notion for taking 12 spatial external things and building a habitat for 100 people to float in low Earth orbit. So you could do that maybe by using, you know, keeping that first stage in orbit from the Starship, the heavy booster, if you can get it all the way to orbit. I know you can do it with the core tank of the Space Launch System. The Space Launch System is a very expensive booster. You know, we're talking $2 billion a launch. They're talking about $2 million a launch with a Starship and carrying a lot more payload. So it's a big difference. It's a radical approach. And, I think SpaceX has accomplished miracles, but, you know, they need to keep their heads screwed on in terms of the risk that they're dealing with. You know, they underestimated what would happen to their pad, and they just really just ate the place out there. You know, they blew a crater where this thing launched, and that stuff scattered all the way to Port Isabel. You know, they had concrete and rock dust everywhere.
Well, Virgin Atlantic kind of learned a lesson on that last disaster they had. That was very costly. And I think it almost put them out of the whole space race, didn't it?
Well, listen, space is difficult. It's difficult to reach space and do the things that have to be done.
That's a great place to segue to the next time we talk to Craig. This is going
to cut. So much to talk about. Y'all need to get me back on.
We are going
to talk fully about countermeasures for these balloons.
For heaven's sakes. We're going to do it again really soon.
Oh, yeah, and there's a bill. Hey, I did have some success.
Uh-oh.
I already got a bill in the Senate. Senate Bill 1631.
Email it to me and I will add it to the website because this thing's going to cut us off automatically with the news. But you are amazing, and we love it. Greg Allison has been our guest.
On,
you can
Greg.
Find everything at wethepeopleradio.us. It's a cool place.